and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Donald Trump's first intelligence briefing today by the Office of the Director of National Intelligence at a secure FBI facility. Trump was accompanied by his friend Governor Chris Christie and the former head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, General Michael Flynn, who is there at his side because Trump does not trust intelligence information from those currently in charge. Ali Watkins, a Washington, D.C.-based journalist who covers national security for BuzzFeed News, who previously covered national security for McClatchy Newspaper's D.C. Bureau, joins us to discuss the likelihood that Trump will get a bland and sanitized overview of the threat landscape without operational details, given the difficult task briefers have in exposing national secrets to Trump, who often claims to be revealing secret information like Obama's payoff to Iran for hostages that only took place in his imagination. Then, following a very effective and well-crafted speech that Donald Trump delivered in Milwaukee last night, we will speak with Dr. Kerwin Swint, a professor of politics at Kennesaw State University who specializes in campaigns, elections, and mass media. The author of Dark Genius, the influential career of legendary political operative and Fox News founder Roger Ailes, he joins us to discuss whether Roger Ailes, who is reported to be helping prep Trump for the debates, has his fingerprints on last night's speech that has all the earmarks of adult supervision. Then finally, we'll examine the extreme weather events underway with deadly floods in Louisiana and out-of-control fires in California that have forced over 82,000 people from their homes, and speak with Forbes Tompkins, a research analyst at the Global Climate Program at the World Resources Institute, whose work focuses on the analysis of climate change impacts throughout the U.S. With this July the hottest on record, according to NOAA and NASA, and the floods in Louisiana classified by NOAA as the eighth flood considered to be a once-in-every-500-years event in this year alone, we will look into the obvious links between extreme weather and climate change. And joining us now is Ali Watkins, who's a Washington, D.C.-based journalist who covers national security and foreign policy for BuzzFeed News and previously covered national security for the Huffington Post and McClatchy Newspaper's D.C. Bureau. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ali Watkins.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And today, Donald Trump was given a briefing by some people from the Office of the Director of National Intelligence at Secure Room, as they call it, the SCIF in the FBI headquarters. I believe it was in New York, was it not?
Yeah, he was in New York, the FBI office there.
And he was accompanied by Governor Chris Christie, his friend, and General Michael Flynn, the former head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, who spoke at the Republican convention. What we were told beforehand from people like Rudolph Giuliani was that Michael Flynn was there to make sure that the briefing wasn't too vanilla and that he was getting the right stuff, because Trump doesn't trust the intelligence services under this current administration. So pretty ambivalent way to go into a briefing, isn't it? Basically say, I think the briefers are going to lie to me.
Yeah, it was, I believe the story on this hit, I mean, hours before Donald Trump walked into this gift for a briefing of him leveling these kind of unprecedented comments on the intelligence community, saying he doesn't trust any of the United States intelligence community, and that was the reason he'd be bringing former General Flynn to the table. I mean, those comments were kind of off the bar for a lot of different reasons. I mean, the intelligence community is a massive, massive apparatus, and this is something that has often escaped Donald Trump's comments on the intelligence community, or IC, as it's colloquially referred to, and just greater conversations about the IC. But the IC is a massive employer. I mean, there's millions of people who work in the intelligence community, and there are obviously people at the top echelons who are political appointees and politicize certain aspects of intelligence. But there are millions of people on the ground working on it, and for Trump to suggest that any of those people, the millions of people working on the ground, but he doesn't trust them either, is pretty crazy. And I think he even made a comment about wanting to, you know, that General Flynn was his first step of completely kind of wiping the slate clean and starting over with groups of people that he thinks he can trust in intel, and essentially wiping out an entire decades-old infrastructure of intelligence gathering. So, I mean, unprecedented on a million fronts.
Well, but General Flynn himself is a little controversial. He was accepted an invitation and sat two seats away from Vladimir Putin at the 10th anniversary of RT, which is Russia Today, which is the propaganda outlet for the Kremlin. And he, at the convention itself, the Republican convention, he made a very stinging attack on Hillary Clinton. And then when the audience were chanting, "Lock her up, lock her up," General Flynn said, "Yeah, lock her up, lock her up." You know, this is a guy that served under Hillary Clinton when she was the Secretary of State. That's pretty unprecedented in itself, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, not trying to put a spin on it, but descent into this very strange, dark rabbit hole is something that I think a lot of reporters who covered him when he was in the military and people who worked with him in the military have watched with kind of a lot of confusion at what his end game might be in a Trump administration. I mean, the assumption is obviously that he will be appointed to head, you know, CIA, something along those lines. But there are also, you know, another strange part to this Flynn political story is that, you know, one of the basic rules of military, if you talk to anyone, you know, not necessarily in Pentagon, but anyone in the huge apparatus of the United States military, the number one rule is they're not political. They're headed by a civilian appointee, but they, you know, their job is to defend and protect the United States of America and be at the call of the commander-in-chief. And to see a general swing so far from that precedent and to get so political and so politically vested with an individual campaign, let alone one that is as far from the norm as Trump, is not something that I think we've seen in a long time.
Well, I think Trump genuinely wanted him to be his vice president. That's my understanding. And, you know, the others, Reince Priebus and I guess Manafort and others weighed in and, you know, lobbied for Mike Pence. So there's clearly a connection or a bond between these two, is there not?
Yes, I mean, very much so. And I'm not sure that we've really learned a ton of details on how that started. I'm not super familiar with how that relationship started. But it's clearly only gotten stronger. I mean, I think the more one kind of, if one makes a controversial comment, the other will generally align with him. So it's very much a going down with the ship arrangement.
And again, I'm speaking with Ali Watkins, who's a Washington, D.C.-based journalist who covers national security and foreign policy for BuzzFeed News and previously covered national security for the Huffington Post and McClatchy Newspapers, D.C. Bureau. So given what was said about the intelligence community prior to this briefing, the briefers themselves, if they weren't a little annoyed, they certainly probably were a little concerned about Donald Trump going off half-cocked. I mean, he's sort of some things that operate in his imagination. He's referred to as top secret information, like he was revealing that the Obama administration paid off the Iranians to get hostages back, and it turned out to be totally in his imagination. So they must be a little trepidatious. So what kind of a briefing do you think he got in terms of, you know, whether or not, I'm sure that he would not have gotten any operational details, right?
No, certainly. I mean, and I don't know that it's specific to Donald Trump. At this point in the campaign, you know, after the candidates receive the official nomination, they become eligible for these briefs. They are receiving everything. I mean, regardless if it's Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton, you know, going years back in campaigns, they're very, very macro-level briefings. And if you talk to any intelligence official, you know, they'd say these are kind of to, you know, give the candidate a foundation, give them the groundwork for, you know, the big issues that they should be paying attention to. But there's really not going to be anything super sensitive, certainly not to the level of sources and methods told to them in these briefings. You might scrape along some secret level of things, but you're not getting to a TF level. You're not getting to, you know, a code word cleared kind of level. That being said, I think that as Trump sits in on more of these briefings, which will happen until Election Day, and then starting, you know, November 9th, whoever the candidate is will get the full presidential daily brief. But until that point, I think the concern that the IC is really wrangling with is not necessarily the content that Trump may or may not get in these briefings, because as I said, it's pretty macro level. There's probably nothing he'll hear that you couldn't get from, you know, really deep news source. I think the real concern, and it was, you know, the perfect example was this issue with the Iranian video, is what will Trump use these classified briefings to say? You know, it becomes a very convenient shield, you know, saying, oh, I saw this in a classified briefing, you know, we saw the Iranians giving money to the U.S., et cetera, et cetera. It's a very obscure tape that he can kind of lay over whatever crazy charge he wants to make and say he heard it in a classified briefing. And by the nature of classified briefings, and we saw this with the Iran video, the U.S. intelligence community or whoever briefed him cannot come out publicly and say, that's not true, that wasn't in the briefing, or that was in the briefing, but it happened like this. You know, we're in a very strange catch-22 kind of situation where you can't confirm or deny whatever happened in a SCIF or a secret-level briefing. So what is Trump going to be able to use these briefings to say, and how much will his supporters believe him, is the real question, I think. I think that's a real concern. There's probably a secondary concern that the IC is kind of dealing with. And, you know, it's not necessarily that he'd leak something out of this meeting, because he's not going to hear too many crazy things. It's what could he do with this new power and this new black hole that the U.S. intelligence community can't clarify.
Well, of course, these briefings began in 1952 under President Truman. And, of course, the first person to be offered them was the Republican, former Democrat, I guess, Republican, Dwight D. Eisenhower. And the reason apparently Truman did this was because when FDR died, he was completely unprepared. He was not briefed on anything. He didn't even know about the atomic bomb. So Truman honestly believed that future presidents should not be ignorant of intelligence matters. And what was interesting, I think, in the next briefings that took place, Eisenhower apparently was furious with Jack Kennedy's campaign based on the missile gap. You know, Kennedy was essentially did an end run around Eisenhower by out-hawking him during the Cold War by saying that the Russians were way ahead on missiles. And of course, Eisenhower knew from the U-2 program that the opposite was true and that there was no missile gap. But he was just absolutely infuriated. And I'm wondering whether, I'm not sure that JFK got the real news from these briefings, that his entire political campaign was bogus. But let's assume that Donald Trump learned a few things about how the real world operates in this briefing today. Do you think it will make a difference with him?
Well, you know, 2 hours before he was going to sit in on the briefing, he said he wasn't going to believe anything they said. So I guess if you take him at his word, probably not. I think the real test of how seriously Trump will take these briefings is who we see him surround himself with over the next 6 weeks, 2 months, whatever we're at here in the countdown. You know, we obviously know that Flynn is a central figure to his campaign. We don't know too much else who he would rely on defense-wise. Or where his priorities are outside of these huge macro-level statements of, I don't trust any of them. You know, would he turn a lot of his focus inward on domestic issues? Would he work a lot over, you know, would he prioritize the FBI over CIA? Would he focus more on military intelligence? It's those kinds of micro-level details that I don't think we have any idea about with Trump yet, outside of these bombastic statements. So the real test for him, you know, obviously this is kind of day one of a new phase in his commander-in-chiefdom, potential at least, and it's where he's going to go from here and where he's going to take that I think is going to determine what kind of national security administration we even envision a Trump kind of set up to be, because there's been a lot of posturing, there's been a lot of, and he's given us more than enough to go off of to build these kinds of ideas of what it might look like. But as far as micro-level details, we don't know the kind of people he wants to surround himself with outside of Michael Flynn when it comes to defense issues. And I think, you know, coming from these kinds of briefings, we're going to see, you know, in the next couple of weeks, a very important evolution in how Donald Trump handles this. And if he doesn't evolve, then, I mean, that's a development, too. So it's kind of day one in him reinventing his Trump administration national security policy, and it started today at, you know, 11 Eastern Standard, whenever he went into that room.
Well, just in closing, though, it does seem there are some analogies with Ike's administration giving JFK briefings. And, of course, the other person getting the briefings was the vice president, Richard Nixon, who already knew a lot. And that's obviously the case with Hillary Clinton. So it'd be interesting, just in closing, to speculate on whether Trump was told, by the way, ISIS is all but finished and it's completely junior varsity, as Obama described it. And your entire campaign beating the drum about ISIS is bogus. What would you, that might be a little embarrassing.
Yeah, I'm hoping that in the next, you know, on November 9th, I hope whatever briefers are sitting at that table will decide to reach out to some reporters and tell them what it was actually like to sit there.
Right. Well, Allie Watkins, I thank you so much for joining us, and I appreciate your time.
Ian, thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Allie Watkins, who's a Washington, D.C.-based journalist who covers national security and foreign policy for BuzzFeed News and previously covered national security for the Huffington Post and McClatchy Newspapers' D.C. Bureau. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the very effective and well-crafted speech that Donald Trump delivered in Milwaukee last night. But they beg you, wait, my name. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Dr. Kerwin Swint, an author, speaker, and professor of politics at Kennesaw State University in Atlanta, where he specializes in campaigns and elections and mass media. He's the author of Dark Genius, the influential career of legendary political operative and Fox News founder Roger Ailes. And his latest book is The King Whisperers, Power Behind the Throne, From Rasputin to Rove. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Kerwin Swint.
Thank you, Ian.
And the fact that Donald Trump, although it's a disputed fact, the Trump campaign say it's not a done deal, but the New York Times has been reporting that Roger Ailes is going to be helping Trump with the debates with Hillary Clinton. But it looks, though, from my point of view, having watched the speech that Trump made last night in Milwaukee, that already there seems to be some adult supervision there. It's almost as though Roger Ailes' fingerprints are on this speech that Trump made last night, which was an extremely effective, well-written, well-crafted speech. And what do you think? Do you think that that Ailes is playing a bigger role than even what the New York Times is reporting?
Well, everything we've seen and read seems to indicate he is playing a role, at least in debate preparation, and as you suggest, possibly in appearances already and in speeches. And I agree with you, that was a very well-delivered speech last night. You know, it's really interesting if Roger Ailes is involved like this, because one of the curious things about Trump and the way he's run his campaign is the seeming lack of top professionals involved in his campaign, from top-flight political consultants and strategists. You know, he seems to use people that have not been that involved in national politics, or at least are underprepared or underknown. And so here he is using one of the best-known people of the last half century in American politics, Roger Ailes. That's quite a development. It could be a stunning development.
And, of course, the law and order was the theme, and that, of course, harks back to President Nixon, who Roger Ailes apparently literally came up with that phrase in helping re-elect Nixon. The law and order, let me just quote from the speech. Law and order must be restored, said Trump. It must be restored for the sake of all, but most especially for the sake of those living in the affected communities. The main victims of these riots are law-abiding African-American citizens living in these neighborhoods. It is their jobs, their homes, their schools, and communities which will suffer as a result. Now, appealing to African-Americans, which he did, to vote for him, is a bit of a chimera, I think, on his part. First of all, he gave the speech in an extremely white, comfortable part of Milwaukee, well away from the area that was affected by the riots. But I think the tactic of reaching out to people who are victims of crime as opposed to those that committed crime, it may be disingenuous, but it's a pretty effective.
Well, you have to wonder how effective it's going to be if he's trying to get minority votes. You know, it may be too little, too late. He may have lost any ounce of credibility with minority voters by this point. But returning to that theme of law and order is not a bad move at all. I mean, it was one of the major highlights of his convention speech, and it's something that he and his campaign think can go a long way in reassuring a lot of voters out there. And you know, some of these swing states, for example, that he cares about them, and he cares about reestablishing feelings of safety, security, law and order. You know, that's an important concept, and it's something a lot of voters may appeal to.
Well, my thought, though, is that not that it's going to appeal to African American voters, but given that it was an entirely white suburban middle-class audience that loved the speech, it seems to me in many ways it's a feel-good moment for Trump's supporters who obviously like the idea that they're not racist but actually have some compassion. And there is a kind of theme that they can all agree on. And of course, he added to it attacking Hillary Clinton by saying she had fostered the dangerous anti-police atmosphere in America. And he said that it's easy for Hillary Clinton to turn a blind eye to crime when she has her own private security force. I believe all Americans, not just the powerful, are entitled to security. So I think that's how he brought it home to the broader audience. And again, I think it was quite effective.
Well, it does allow him to talk about a popular theme while at the same time allowing him to pivot and attack Hillary Clinton on that same theme. And blame by association to Barack Obama also. I mean, so, you know, that's a clever way of hitting a theme and making it work for you and giving you ammunition against your opponent. I also do wonder if that's some of the advice of Roger Ailes, because as you say, he was one of the main advisors to Richard Nixon's rise in 1968 and helped Richard Nixon conquer television with those programs that Roger Ailes produced. And law and order was a big theme in that era. So this could be an Ailes fix.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Kerwin Swint, who's an author, speaker, and professor of politics at Kennesaw State University in Atlanta, specializing in campaigns and elections and mass media. He's the author of Dark Genius, The Influential Career of Legendary Political Operative and Fox News Founder Roger Ailes. And his latest book is The King Whisperers, Power Behind the Throne, from Rasputin to Rove. And now when we talk about the possibility that Ailes is already having an influence on Trump, certainly we know that they're friends. And my suspicion is that Ailes is one of the few people that Trump would actually listen to. And it looks as if he is listening to somebody. I refer to it as adult supervision. At the same time, of course, he's reshuffled his campaign and brought on some fairly wingnut ideologues. Stephen Bannon, the CEO of Breitbart News, he, of course, thinks that Fox News, which is Ailes' creation, is tame. And then Kellyanne Conway, of course, his spokesperson as well, is now the new campaign manager. So if Ailes is being brought on, he's balancing that with the even more extreme people that are going to throw red meat as opposed to reach out to the center, which is necessary for anybody who wants to become president of the United States.
Well, you know, that's sort of what I was talking about earlier when I said that, you know, Trump seems to have surrounded himself with people who have little to no experience running presidential campaigns. Steve Bannon from Breitbart has no experience in that kind of environment. Kellyanne Conway, although a very talented pollster and a good political analyst, she's never run managed a presidential campaign. I mean, so that seems to be what Trump has done this year. So the Roger Ailes bit is an anomaly in, you know, in that kind of organization. I don't know how involved Ailes is going to be, but, I mean, he's somebody Trump obviously listens to and respects. They've known each other for a very long time, and I know that Donald Trump respects Ailes' judgment.
Well, just again from the speech last night, which I suspect had Ailes' fingerprints on it, and certainly if Trump had started out of the gate delivering these kind of speeches as opposed to insulting minorities and everybody else, I think he'd be a level, if not ahead, of Hillary Clinton. This is the theme that it sort of lifted from Bernie Sanders, really. It is time for rule by the people, not rule by special interests. Every insider getting rich off our broken system is throwing money at Hillary Clinton, the hedge fund managers, the Wall Street investors, the professional political class. It's the powerful protecting the powerful, insiders fighting for insiders. I'm fighting for you. What do you think?
Well, I mean, again, he returns to that convention speech where he said, I'm the only guy standing up for you, the working class, the people that are being left behind, and the people that are being left behind by this rigged system. You know, he keeps talking about, you know, the rigged system in various different ways. I think it's a good message for him to go back to. I think if he can recapture some of the momentum he had around the time of the convention, that would go a long way as far as riding his ship right now. You know, he's been just really stepping on his own message left and right ever since that convention. So maybe Ailes can help him get back on track.
And in terms of this media bashing that he's been doing lately, Rush Limbaugh, of course, yesterday said it's a bad idea. You never go after the media. You sound like you're a loser. You're a complainer. It's a no-win situation. But again, the people that support Trump really hate the media.
As far as someone in Donald Trump's shoes, I mean, attacking the media, how much worse is the media coverage going to get for you? I mean, you know, if the media coverage is bad now, it can only get so much worse. So why not go after the media? Because, you know, that's a constant theme. A lot of the voters that are going to vote for Donald Trump is they don't trust the media at all, except for, of course, Fox News.
Well, along those lines, in the speech last night, Trump said, we are going to make this a government of the people once again. This is our chance to take back power from all the people who've taken it from you. The reason you see the establishment media lining up behind my opponent is because they are scared that you, with your vote, can take away their power and return it to your family and community. So there are the battle lines. If it's Donald Trump versus the media, a lot of people in this country are going to vote for Donald Trump.
Well, they will, and I think Trump's challenge is to make this campaign decision for the voters in those swing states more about Hillary Clinton and less about him. You know, I mean, if he's the issue, then he loses. And unfortunately for him, he's made himself the issue too often the last 2 or 3 weeks. And, of course, Hillary Clinton is trying to make that happen, and the media may play an assisting role in that. So he's got to counter that. He's got to make the issue once again Hillary, not him.
Well, towards the end of the speech, there was almost a sort of George Lakoff moment where Lakoff has always argued that the Democrats or the political left doesn't know how to frame arguments and the right are extremely clever at it. The obvious example being the difference between pro-life and pro-choice, which is the better framing there. But what Trump said last night towards the end is, my opponent asks her supporters to repeat a three-word pledge. Her pledge reads, I'm with her. I choose to recite a different pledge. My pledge reads, I'm with you, the American people. Again, I think a much more effective framing.
It's very clever. I mean, that's a good way to frame it, and it's a good message that you could see ending up in TV ads in these swing states. You know, I mean, I would leave it just, I'm with you. I wouldn't even say the American people at the end. I think that actually waters it down a little bit. But, you know, the I'm with you, the three-part, very strong. You know, that could be used to great effect, I think.
So since you've profiled Roger Ailes, he's obviously gone through a bit of a turmoil lately with his firing from Fox, which I understand was engineered by Murdoch's two sons, James and Lachlan, who are pretty much taking over the business. But they've managed to keep some of Ailes' loyalists in charge. Is that, do you think, a transitional situation?
It's definitely transitional. You know, there has been a succession plan in place for a while, and we're finally starting to see some of that come to fruition this week. I think in some sense it'll be a little bit of a freedom for Roger Ailes to be able to get back into politics. I mean, I don't think he ever really wanted to completely leave politics. He had to, of course, being a broadcast executive, but he's always kept his finger in there, and he's always tried to stir the pot. And as I've always said, he's always run Fox News like a political consultant would run a political organization. And so I think he might have quite a bit to add to a Trump campaign. It'll be fascinating.
And $40 million payout doesn't hurt.
That lets him rest easy. And I believe he also has a four-year non-compete agreement with News Corp, so it's not like he can run over to NBC or CNN or anywhere else and work in broadcasting right away. So he might as well do politics.
And if he is going to be prepping Trump for the debates, when would that normally start?
Well, the first debate, I think, is September 26th. So normally, you know, depending on who the candidate is, a couple of weeks out, maybe 3 weeks out, they start boning up a little bit. And then a week to 10 days before, they really start to drill and practice. The fascinating thing about Roger Ailes helping Donald Trump prepare for these debates is the assistance he provided to Ronald Reagan in 1984, you know, this is a well-known story where Reagan stumbled in the first debate against Walter Mondale, looked bad, but Roger Ailes came and gave him some advice, worked with him a little bit, and in the second debate, Reagan was totally in control, totally the Gipper that people had known. And apparently what Roger Ailes says he did was he just made him more comfortable with himself. You know, less drilling and more sort of one-liners and optimism. If he could do the same for Trump, if he could make Trump more comfortable with being himself and having sort of an optimistic presentation of himself, that could do wonders for his public image.
Well, apparently Ailes was responsible for the line that Reagan delivered because they were worried about his age and the contrast between his age and Mondale's. And Reagan delivered the famous line apparently attributed to Ailes, which is,
yep,
I won't make the youth and inexperience of my opponent an issue in this campaign.
That's so, it. That's exactly right. And yeah. Ailes said, be that kind of candidate, be that kind of optimistic, humorous personality that people can connect with. Because on a TV debate, the voters really want to connect with the candidate. They want to be comfortable with them. And if you can manage that, then you're ahead of the game.
So the speech last night that I've been quoting from, Cohen's went, there's no way in the world that Stephen Bannon, the new Trump campaign manager, actually he's not, he's the CEO of the campaign.
That's right.
They've still got Manafort as the chairman of the campaign, even though he is apparently, by all accounts, essentially being demoted. So you've got the Breitbart CEO, Stephen Bannon, now as the CEO of the campaign, and Kelly Conway, the campaign manager. There's no
right.
way in the world that those two ideologues had their fingerprints on this speech, as far as I can tell. It does seem much, much more like Roger Ailes gave it a once-over.
That's probably likely, yeah. I wouldn't think that Bannon or Conway would have made that kind of impact on a speech this quickly. It could be Ailes, or it could be Trump going back to a formula that's worked at certain times in the campaign where he's more disciplined, he's sticking closer to the script and better able to get his talking points across rather than instead of reacting to things that are shouted from the audience, which is what really trips him up.
Well, it does seem, though, that according to most of the polls, it may be too little too late in terms of the trajectory he's been on. Do you think that... I mean, after Labor Day, the assumption is that things start in earnest in campaigns. But before Labor Day, which is the time now where Hillary Clinton's spending an awful lot of money on TV ads, is the time when you frame the public's opinion of your opponent and of yourself. Do you think Trump has missed that window by his persistent outbursts and negative rants?
Well, it could very well be. I mean, normally... after Labor Day, more and more voters start to tune in to the campaign, and you see more ads running in those key swing states. And so there is still usually time to rehabilitate your image or define your opponent in negative ways. You do have to wonder, though, this time Donald Trump has taken such a hit in the polls over the last 2 or 3 weeks, and there's been so much coverage of the negative statements, you know, him stepping on his message, him saying unthoughtful things, that, you know, has he damaged himself to the point where a recovery just isn't possible at this point? In some ways, we're in a bit of an unprecedented arena here because we haven't had a candidate like Donald Trump to use as a role model. And so it's, you know, it's tempting to say that it's too late, but you never know. I mean, in 1988, George H.W. Bush was 17 points down to Michael Dukakis in August, and he came back to win. So nothing's impossible.
Well, even Hillary Clinton, I think, has figured that one out. She yesterday called upon her supporters not to be complacent, and that could be a problem. If she's so far ahead in the polls, people may figure, oh, well, you know, she's going to win by a big margin. I don't have to bother to vote. And you do have the other factor, of course, with Gary Johnson gaining, I think he's up to about 10% now, and Jill Stein around 5%. Although my understanding is that when people actually go into the ballot box to make their choices on November the 8th, those that are thinking about voting for a third-party candidate as opposed to the lesser of the two evils, as they normally characterize the front runners, they usually basically come to their senses and think, well, I can't take a chance on the other person getting elected. So do you believe in that theory, that the third-party people's numbers will drop off pretty much just before or on Election Day?
Well, that's normally what we see. I mean, it's very hard for them to make much of an impact. The biggest impact a third-party or independent candidate usually makes is hurting one of the two major candidates in certain states. Like in 2000, for example, Ralph Nader, who was the Green Party nominee, definitely hurt Al Gore in a few of those key states. And some people even say Ralph Nader may have cost Al Gore that election. You could make a similar case with Ross Perot in 1992, hurting George H.W. Bush. So that's usually the impact that a third-party candidate makes, is they end up tilting the election to one side or the other in certain circumstances.
Yeah, and usually the side that's opposite to their ideology. Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Dr. Cohen-Swint.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Cohen-Swint, who's an author, speaker, and professor of politics at Kennesaw State University in Atlanta, specializing in campaigns and elections and mass media. He's the author of Dark Genius, The Influential Career of Legendary Political Operative and Fox News Founder Roger Ailes. And his latest book is The King Whisperers, Power Behind the Throne, From Rasputin to Rove. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back examining the extreme weather events underway with deadly floods in Louisiana and out-of-control fires in California. I'm amazed at what the people say. I'm amazed by a divided nation. I'm amazed at the love we rejected. I'm amazed we accepted this place. After all is said and done. If it keeps on raining, that beast's gonna break. If it keeps on raining, that beast's gonna break. When the levee breaks, have no place to stay. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Forbes Tompkins, who's a research analyst in the Global Climate Program at the World Resources Institute, where his work focuses on the analysis of climate change impacts throughout the United States and strategies of mitigation and resiliency at the local, state, and federal level. Welcome to Background Briefing, Forbes Tompkins.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And the month of July has been recorded as the hottest month ever recorded since at least 1880. And that is according to data from both NASA and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administrations. And on top of that, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administrations have also classified this latest flood in Louisiana as the eighth flood, considered to be a once in every 500-year event in this year. So clearly something's happening.
That's right, Ian. Yeah, it's unfortunately becoming a more and more common theme in the U.S. and around the world, of where we're seeing these once considered once in 100-year events, once in 500, even once in 1,000-year events, are actually becoming more and more frequent. I think, as you might have noted, we've already had a number of these just in the past 12 months. And unfortunately, again, that's kind of the theme that we would expect in a warming atmosphere that really provides a lot of fuel for these types of storms to tap into and amplify.
But of course, it's a 1-2 punch. You're having these floods in Louisiana, but you're also having here, where I'm speaking from, California, Los Angeles, we have a new fire. It's known as the Blue Cut Fire. It's out of control. 82,000 people have been evacuated. They don't know how many homes have burned. And this is like, I think, the third or fourth major fire in the state, and the fire season's normally in October.
That's correct as well, and I think that's what's important about climate change to note is it's more of these extremes that we're seeing more and more of. So it's on both ends of the scale, just like you said, a 1-2 punch of sorts. And we're seeing out west conditions more conducive for drought, to amplify drought, the same with wildfires. You know, you can go down the spectrum of extreme weather events. Heavy precipitation, much like what took place in Louisiana, has increased in every single region of the continental U.S. over the last 50 years, even by 71% in the Northeast. You're seeing heat waves that are just unprecedented. Like you noted, July 2016, the hottest month ever on record. That's actually the 379th consecutive month with temperatures above average. So that means anyone who's 31 years old has never been alive for a month of where the temperatures have actually been below average.
So what is this doing in terms of educating people? You know, for example, the chairman of the House Scientific Committee, or the House Committee on Science, Representative Lamar Smith of Texas, is a global warming denier. Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin is a global warming denier. And Senator James Imhoff of Oklahoma are also global warming deniers who scoff at man's role in climate change. And of course, the worst affected country of all is Australia. And there's a senator elect there called Malcolm Roberts, a member of the right-wing nativist One Nation party. He believes that NASA is manipulating data to create the illusion of global warming for whatever. I can't imagine what the motives would be there, but that's nevertheless this canard that they put forth. Are these people going to, be named and shamed in the annals of history, or is anybody listening to them?
Well, I can't speak to the politics of climate change, but going back to the science and the education, I think that's a really important note that you hit on, of we really need to do more in the educational system in the U.S. and around the world, starting at a young age of teaching, you know, the facts of climate change, and more broadly the environmental facts, and it's something that's been missing to this point, I think, and that we could do a lot more to scale up now, and we'll see the results with the next generation that's really faced with the brunt of these issues that we're seeing more and more of. And some of those efforts are starting today. There are some encouraging signs of a lot of educational outreach, a lot of tools, resources being developed by folks like NOAA and others and NGOs, like the one I'm with. We're really trying to communicate these issues that can appear as a distant future problem, a problem for future generations, third world countries. It's actually a problem that's impacting a lot of us in our backyards today already. People just don't realize it.
And again, I'm speaking with Forbes Tompkins, who's a research analyst in the Global Climate Program at the World Resources Institute, where his work focuses on the analysis of climate change impacts throughout the United States and strategies of mitigation and resiliency at the local, state, and federal level. Well, it would seem to me, Forbes, that a good place to start in terms of educating the public would be with the people who do the weather on television. They get a lot of time. They usually, you know, some of them look kind of like Playboy bunnies. You know, they're usually very perky, attractive blondes. But there's a big difference between the weather and climate. And you get the impression that almost every weather report you see, even these disasters that they're showing us now, are never put in the context of global warming.
Yeah, that's an interesting point and valid of kind of the disconnect between meteorology, you know, weather and climate change. And oddly enough, I'm actually a meteorologist who went on to study climate change and energy policy. So speaking from personal experience, I think the challenge for the meteorological and weather community with respect to climate change actually stems from the differing scales of time and space between the two. So meteorology is more directly related to weather taking place in the moment, or even perhaps looking forward a matter of days, maybe a couple weeks. Climatology, on the other end, is actually an average of weather over long periods of time, typically around 30 years. So you can imagine it's understandable that meteorologists might not pick up on these long-term trends that we're seeing in weather because they're forecasting more in the now, more of predicting how hot, cold, windy, or wet it's going to be in their community, and their interest is less about why it's getting hotter, windier, or wetter.
But they must have noticed that the weather is getting more intense and these massive destructive weather events are getting more and more frequent.
It's true. And I think there's more coverage that we're seeing of these events, and rightfully so, because they're happening more frequently. And the meteorology community is trying to address the issue of making climate change more of a prevalent issue, highlighting it more in their coverage. Again, we're kind of at the starting line of that initiative, but there are a number of groups trying to better educate some of these TV meteorologists. And a point that you alluded to was, you know, some of the TV meteorologists, and I'm not sure what the percent is, actually don't have degrees in meteorology. So they're not really scientists, and they don't really know the background, science, physics, and mathematics that goes into understanding the weather, but also climate. So there's a number of challenges that are facing the weather community.
Well, that was what I was alluding to, referring to the Playboy Bunny type weather ladies who look like they're cast based on their figures, how they look in a bikini as opposed to what they know about the weather. But that aside, what efforts are specifically being done to educate weather? Because some of them are meteorologists, you know, some of them are actually quite credible. But I guess the going after the ratings means that you have to have somebody that's eye candy as opposed to brain candy.
Well, yeah, I mean, you can't judge a book by its cover, so I think that's important to note. So, you know, judging by how someone might look, they might have a PhD in meteorology for all we know, but looks and attractiveness are variables that are taken into account for TV meteorologists, and there's actually a number of initiatives taking place right now by groups like Climate Central, who have a Climate Matters initiative of where they create graphics based on recent climate data that they kind of dispense to meteorologists to use at their free will in case they want to include any type of graphics or a segment on climate change. As you can probably appreciate with your radio show, you actually only have a very small amount of time as a TV meteorologist, whether it's a matter of 30 seconds at most, maybe a couple of minutes, to get through a lot of information. So it's tough to bring in the context of climate change when it can be pretty difficult to distill the details and the intrinsic science that's involved. So groups like Climate Central are doing a fantastic job of making these graphics more readily available that can visually do the job that sometimes it's really difficult to explain.
But in terms of the self-reinforcing effects of global warming, which is one of the kind of scariest parts of it, is, which, for example, as the ice packs melt, the ratio of the sunlight that's reflected back into outer space from the white ice and snow goes down compared to the dark oceans, which are increasing as the white area shrinks. the darker area grows. That's just the way it is. And that means that less and less sunlight's being reflected back into outer space, adding to the greenhouse effect. And then you have the effect of the melting tundra, which is releasing enormous amounts of methane, which is an incredibly virulent global warming gas. And then on top of that, it would seem that these fires, and, you know, literally from where I'm speaking, on the horizon, there's this just great pall of brown smoke. That's got to be also adding to global warming, isn't it? I mean, isn't that the problem with global warming? Is that so much of it, unless it's curbed quickly, has a kind of self-reinforcing factor?
That's correct. Yeah, that's unfortunately the added challenge to the issue is we only have so much time that we can really address the issue before it gets out of hand. And there are some self-reinforcing cycles that feed off of each other. You know, the reduced snow coverage that you were alluding to is the albedo effect. And essentially, I think anyone can appreciate if you stand on asphalt that's dark and black, it's extremely hotter than it might be on, you know, something that's paved white nearby. It just has, it's able to absorb more sunlight, and that actually can warm the ocean and can actually amplify sea level rise, which is an extreme impact of climate change that almost all coastal communities in the U.S. have been dealing with. Increasingly, we're seeing rates of 300% to 900% increases in coastal flooding on all three coasts of the U.S. And then, yeah, I mean, just to second what you said following that, of just a number of reinforcing factors are causing us to really grapple with the impacts of climate change now. It's something that's becoming less of a problem just for the next generation, but as the science evolves, our understanding of the models evolve, it's very clearly becoming an impact that we're dealing with today in our backyards.
But since you work on mitigation and resiliency for local, state, and federal, at the federal, local, and state level, what about some of the suggestions that I've heard that seem to be sort of doable? One of them was that if everybody on the planet painted their roof white, it would make a difference. Have you heard that idea?
You can hear around the rumor mill some of these ideas. I mean, would it make an impact? Absolutely. How practical is it to actually get community, state, federal, national buy-in to do something like that? That's when things really start to get complicated. So, I mean, there's a wide range of measures that we can take, and I think one of the most pressing issues when we're talking about with respect to extreme weather events and dealing with those types of impacts, what we need to see is a change from the mentality of this response and reactive mentality to extreme weather events. We need to be more proactive. You can't just solve a problem after it starts, because that's how we got here in the first place with climate change. So much of the federal assistance policies and action plans at the local level, and unfortunately, it tends to take a Katrina or a Hurricane Sandy to impact an area before they actually start taking action to address it. So that's something that I think is very doable in the near term if we can just have people form a plan now, whether that's reduce their greenhouse gas emissions or become more resilient to these impacts, and optimally both. But I think that is actually one of the most achievable things that most communities and states and at the federal level can do now.
So what is the would be the, I mean, notwithstanding that you have the head of the science committee in the House being a global warming denier, and it's obviously even though they I think Exxon and others have gotten out of the global warming denial business, or at least they're backpedaling, you still got Senators Ron Johnson and James Imhoff, et cetera, and others. I'm not sure how much they're stopping progress, but what practical and simple steps could the average person listening to this program do? You know, we all try to recycle and do things like that, even though it doesn't often feel like it's particularly productive. Is there any Are there any simple solutions that people can do, or do all of the, do the solutions require not just governments, but all the governments working together?
Yeah, I mean, again, I can't speak to the politics of the issue, but it's an all-inclusive problem. You know, it's not just your problem, my problem, or anyone else's. It's something that we actually have to work together on to actually comprehensively deal with before it becomes really out of control with some of the extreme weather events and impacts that we'll see moving forward and commit ourselves to in the future. So, you know, with the work that I do, that I have a strong belief that there is a lot of potential kind of at the grass tops of local governments because they're the folks that are on the ground dealing with the impacts of climate change and needing solutions because, you know, they're oftentimes not just the mayor or the city councilman, they actually might own a restaurant or a bait and tackle shop that's becoming more and more flooded. So they want answers themselves, and I'm a firm believer that, you know, locally, these groups, regardless of political party, are willing to come to the table and act. So I think you can have almost a bottom-up effect, but you're going to need the private sector, civil society, and all levels of government really to come together. So we're making progress, but there's still a long way to go.
And just in closing, do the rural communities, which normally, you know, vote conservatively and would support people like Ron Johnson and James Imhoff, I imagine farmers, they've got to be seeing the effects of global warming, surely.
Yeah, the agricultural sector has definitely been grappling with the impacts of climate change through, you know, more amplified or intensified drought and more extremes. It doesn't need to be a drought necessarily, but just extremes in precipitation. If you go through periods without precipitation, rainfall in particular, the ground can become very hardened, and it's much more difficult for it to absorb water. So then when you do get precipitation and it's falling at heavier rates than it might have previously, you lose all the nutritional value that could be absorbed, and you actually can see erosion in some of the fertile crops and also their base of which they're planted in, and you get a lot of runoff, and that can actually introduce the risk of flooding as well. So this is not just a one solution or a silver bullet solution to the problem, and it's also all-inclusive of the impacts and who's feeling them.
Well, Forbes Tompkins, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for the opportunity, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Forbes Tompkins, who's a research analyst in the Global Climate Program at the World Resources Institute, where his work focuses on the analysis of climate change impacts throughout the United States and strategies of mitigation and resiliency at the local, state, and federal level. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The headline.